Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening.
Evening.
Hi, Martha. The last few talks, we've wanted to make sure that everyone can hear. So if I'm not loud enough, let me know. My name's Travis Marceau, and I'm a Zen student here, and I was asked to give a way-seeking mind talk, and so the title of my talk is Way-Seeking Mind Talk. I've been practicing at Canando for about 10 years, and I am Les K's student. Hi, Les. He's joining us remotely, as are about 6 or 8, I think. Yeah. Hi, Janet. I see some familiar faces there. Hi, Hernan. I just spent the weekend with my aunt, my paternal aunt, Shirley, and she's 34 years older than me, and I have never had that much quality time with her in my life. I think she'd been travel alone. She traveled with her daughter-in-law and her granddaughter. But we had 2 days to be tourists in San Francisco. And I think it's an appropriate thing to talk about where you come from with the way-seeking mind talk. So way-seeking mind is a tradition in our school where people will talk about how they came to practice. So I have to tell you something about my life, but I will talk about it through a spiritual lens, we could say. How I ended up here practicing as a Zen student. And is there anybody who's on like plan A with life here? It's a kind of a complicated concept, but you know, like where you, every once in a while I'll hear, you know, an article or something where, you know, this person knew since they were, you know, very young that they always wanted to do this one thing. And then they went and did it. And that always is remarkable to me. So that's what I mean about plan A. But I think, you know, when you think about your life, if you live a spiritual life, and I know everybody on some level does, but you have to think about where you came from and what your plan A was. And when I was young, I really believed in my ability in a few things, but one thing I really thought I was good at was tennis. And I played tennis a lot when I was very small, and I would even like spend hours on the backboard, which, you know, you don't even need an opponent to do. And that's how I found my dog as a kid, was like, he saw me there. He was a stray dog and just saw me hitting and saw a potential friend. And I took him home, and he lived with us. But I really wanted to achieve something in tennis. And if I think about those dozen odd years, I really wish I would have taken better care of my dog. And now I have a dog, and he's like the dog I had when I was a kid. And I do take very good care of him. And it wasn't easy for me to learn how to do that. But that wasn't my plan A. I'm really glad that that's in my life now. But I was with my aunt, and there were ways in which she was more like me than I was. And I could regale her with stories and factoids and things about Mexican cuisine. And there's just so much to talk about with someone so much like you. And at some point, she turned to my family and said, there was a point, there was a time when a fighter jet flew over Travis's high school, and they announced that Travis had made it into the Air Force Academy. She said it kind of like that. And so, even though tennis was my plan A, I thought that there was something missing, even when I was young. Like, I would get into competitive matches and I would be just rolling. Like, I would win the first set, like 6-0. And then something would happen and I would kind of like lose something. And I didn't know what. And I thought I needed to be stronger or faster or smarter. But I think inside I knew that I was having trouble managing these feelings of achievement, right? Because, I'm playing in just a handful of tournaments a year, and I had these experiences that I now look back on as like panic attacks. Which, I would be, you could imagine what it would be like to be in a match you drive 3 hours to, eat a piece of pizza and then you jump on a court. It's like 95 degrees in the summer and you're playing against this other kid, drinking quarts of water and stuff. And so you can imagine the level of arousal, intensity, excitement. Like I was really pushing myself, right? And so when things were going great, they were going great. But when I would hit some kind of difficulty, or I would hesitate or feel fear, there would be this, and it didn't happen all the time. But since this is a way-seeking mind talk, I have to talk about that. And then I have to talk about the opposite, the sublime, when it was all working out and I couldn't miss. And I saw the ball almost in slow motion. And it was like it was being an artist, but it was really about flying, like feeling like you were completely free, expansive, large, and more than yourself. Because one thing you learn in those moments is you're not really competing in a vacuum. You're intimate with your opponent, and you end up having this like kind of love, real love for the opponent. You understand them, and by understanding them, it makes you a better player. It makes you a more sensitive person. You can handle the wins and the losses, as long as the competition's good. But I really loved it. I love tennis. And I thought the thing I needed was to play college tennis and to do it in a type of structured environment, where I would be getting stronger and faster and all those things. But I had a very strong achievement orientation. And so I went into the Air Force Academy. I wasn't even there when the plane flew over, so I don't even remember this, but it was so odd to hear my aunt talk about this 30 years later. I went in, you lose everything. Like you just come in with yourself and they give you everything. And you start learning about the Air Force and what it is. And this is one of those things where I think this is the main thing that I have a hard time with and why I maybe talk around this thing, because it's maybe so socially awkward or difficult, but I was a kid and I kind of dreamt of flying, as I said. So as my life's kind of gone along, I still dream about flying, but my ideas of flying have shifted. And it's good that I have other experiences with that. But what we're really talking about is the yearning to pick up practice, which is to come into contact with what we call our original mind. That feeling of expansiveness that we have access to all the time. If we don't run past it, if we don't distract ourselves, it's there and it's quite common. But there are so many things that take us away from that. But I think in my way of seeing original mind, the experience of original mind, how I felt weightless on the court, you know, or these moments of connection with everything, feelings of no separation. And there are many ways that that can happen. I think that in that seeing it as flying or as a kind of freedom, expansive freedom, I got confused because I thought, well, with my abilities, I could go fly and wouldn't that be wonderful? But a military organization, the U.S. Air Force, is an organization of violence. It's a type of systematic violence, and it serves the United States of America and its interests. And if I'm saying anything controversial, please say something, but that's how I see it. And even in hearing the word service, I think of going into the service because it's so ubiquitous in American society to kind of confound the two. And there is an almost constant conditioning that is happening to normalize that type of violence. It's painful to live with. It's a burden to know the levels of sophistication of that violence and the way that it's applied and the language that's used around it to justify it. The spending that's happening to maintain and extend a system of violence that's so lethal that its intention is to keep us safe and secure. And when I say us, I mean a very small percentage of the earth and its people, maybe less than 10 to 5 to 3%, something like that. So if we're in that group and we're not really considering it from the inside and the outside. It may be easy to kind of have a narrative that justifies it and allows us to kind of start to parse out between the group we're part of and what we might just say is, oh, the other people. So I wasn't a very good cadet. And I didn't really thrive as a tennis player because I wasn't happy there. And if I had really listened to my heart, I probably would have left after 2 months. And I left after 2 years. And and I left with really shaken confidence, I would say. Because now I'm not on plan A, not even plan A.1, not even, you know, A.1.C. This is definitely plan B. And I went back home. Because even when I was young, I'd always tell myself, I have to leave. I have to get out of this small town in Iowa that I had so much to talk about with my aunt. And she had the same things that she said she knew when she first got into college she couldn't go back. But I knew when I was even younger. And it might be generational because there are, you know, you're watching The Cosby Show and, yeah, and tennis matches. And, you know, I was part of that TV generation. So I got to see things, LA, you know, in the 80s, you know, these things were big, you know, exciting things. So one thing that she said to me after lunch on Monday was, I was just so homesick when I left. We were walking back to the car and I was holding her hand. And I said, I never let myself feel that. And there was a lot of other stuff that I let myself feel. Depression, anxiety, feelings of failure, regret, but I never let myself feel homesick. And I was lucky. I when I went back to Iowa in my first class, I met my wife the first day of my first class. And we just started talking, you know, and never stopped talking. And she never, I think about how I feel accepted as a kind of, like, not really accepting myself or feeling accepted. And then when I met her, it's like after that, it's like that's what being accepted is. And that was a big deal, big deal. So there's these moments of clarity when we see we're exhausted, we're kind of, you know, you got cockleburrs all over you, and you know you're a mess, and it's almost like in those moments you have to be challenged, but you see something new, and that's the beginning of a spiritual journey. That's the path, these things that kind of jump out at you. So I said, you know, my ideas of flying have changed. You know, if I was in the Thunderbirds, I would be, you know, talking about vertical barrel rolls. You know, that's a fun thing to do. start at sea level and put the nose up and just, you know, thousands of feet, you know, maybe thousands of feet per second up really fast. And that's exciting. And, it, you know, you could go through films of the 80s and see why I would think that that's an exciting thing. But that conditioning, how we see the world, what we value, what we actually feel in our hearts versus what our heads think we should be doing. This is our work. This is why we practice. It takes years to work through that. And it's, you don't actually, on some level, have anything else to do. There is nothing else to do, but to work on yourself in that way, to work through the conditioning. And it's different for everyone, but the practice is the same, and the practice works. And when we sit meditation in the mornings, in the evenings, on shashins, in deep meditation, when the senses are limited or for a moment cease, there we are. And that experience of seeing yourself is profound. Just a glimpse. Ah, okay. It can shift your life slowly, slowly. You start to make different choices in your day-to-day life. You start to see things in a different perspective. You start to get along differently in your relations. Certain beliefs that you have are sort of like, you know, ending up at the door, like all those clothes you have to give away to Goodwill. I don't need that anymore. I don't need that. And you're still living your life. You're still finding the moments that make a meaningful life. And I have two wonderful daughters with my wife, and they're amazing. And so my ideas of flying include them. And and their future, and what they're gonna have to go through, which is, it's gonna be challenging. And I will watch them go through and have difficulties like I did. But it's that's all part of it. And we all have to deal with that. And I guess that's what people mean when they say karma. It's, you know, it's these causes and conditions that our lives, where we find ourselves in life. But everybody has a spiritual aspect to their life. That's a belief, I guess. Everybody wants to know what life is about. On some level, I believe, and to get to the heart of things. You know, the story of the Buddha is remarkable in the sense that he's depicted as someone who really didn't lack for anything. And I think there's a solid aspect of practice where we're curious, we want to figure it out. It's not that we're, it's not that there's something wrong with us. And I think that the way that Gautama Siddhartha has wealth, he has status, he has time. But he wants to figure something out. When I became a father, I didn't want to miss being a father. I didn't want to miss the moment. I didn't want to run off and get distracted when they were so cute, you know, and so charming and so needing of me. And one thing that I found was it was very difficult to make progress in that area. And this is after I started practicing. So I was like, I really want to be, you know, a good dad. And actually, like, the work, I needed to be careful with, you know, whether or not it was taking me away from my family. Is my spiritual practice taking me away from them, you know? And it's not necessarily, a discrete answer. And it may be that it vacillated, but with time, it got better. And it was not possible sometimes to see when it was getting better. And my ideas about whether it was getting better or not were so wrong so often. And so now I can like look back and like think about it a little bit more accurately than when I was in it, when I was covered in those cockle burrs and so worn out and afraid, really afraid. For my kids. I wanted them to be healthy and well, and no one's ever the paragon of thriving. We're all working to be healthy and well and caring and compassionate individuals, but they're amazing. My kids are amazing. My wife's amazing. I'm very fortunate in that way. I can't give a way-seeking mind without bringing them into it. I still allow myself to do some flying, but it's mostly with snowboarding now. And they do it too, and. Yeah, it just couldn't be happier with that, how that's worked out. So I hope that tells you something about my life. And I'm kind of in midlife now. Midlife, you know, I'm getting close to, but I can't say I'm not halfway. And I feel like I owe so much to Zen and to Les and to this tradition. And the forms work. So, you know, even if there are a lot of things that can take you away and, you know, you can certainly sit on your own, but this community will help you. And sometimes it will help you by being just the kind of pain in the butt you need, because that's the way it works. And you you grow through that, and you get to see parts of yourself that make you grateful for that difficulty. And you start to see, oh, my difficulty is showing me the things that I can improve in. And I don't need to actually react to this threat or perceived threat in the way I did the previous countless times. That's, you know, It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what we say at coffee, but we come have coffee, and it's still meeting people and witnessing them, and we affirm each other, and we accept each other in the best way we can. And we celebrate when we have breakthroughs, and we're free to talk about our practice, and we do. So just so grateful to have you all, and thank you for coming out tonight. Really appreciate it. Yes, Diane?
Where or how did you come to practice? What I hear your journey, but I didn't hear what, how you found Hanendo, or how you decided that Zen practice was for you.
I found Zen practice when I felt like I was in a professional crisis, but the professional crisis was really a long, protracted plan B, like push, where my life kind of can be looked at from the crisis point or the origin. And so my seventh grade math teacher was named Dev Kadash, and she and her husband Ed ran a technological society for high school students, and both of her kids attended this, but basically it was a social meeting every month where we would get together and talk about engineering and math and what would be considered nerdy stuff at the time. And she basically just told me to go to that class. Like, she was like, no, or it was an after school club, but she's like, you're gonna come, it's this time. And we, you know, this is pre-internet, so it was just a kind of a routine. And I would go and I'd talk with them and another half a dozen kids. And when I was leaving the academy, and I was not going to be a warrior, right? Just think about it on like a very kind of like basic level of professions you can have. You could be a warrior, or you could be a healer, or you could be an engineer, right? So, which would be like a smith in like traditional times, right? And I was like, I am a really bad warrior, and I can't do that. I'd like to help people, but I think I'm good at math. Why do I think I'm good at math? Because of Dev Kadash, and she'd given me this little book called a Pocket Ref. This is before the internet, and you'd get this as a pocket book that would tell you if you forgot the combination of resistor colors and what the size of your tire means, or what the capital cities are in this part of the hemisphere, you know, like this time zone, you know, that sort of thing. And it was just a hodgepodge of facts and trivia. And I approached my career that way. From the point I went into biomedical engineering at Iowa to 2014, I was like, I had a very strong design bias, which means I was probably a very difficult, arrogant, controlling person. And it didn't happen overnight, but with the acquisition of facts and figures and like evidence and data and things, I like over time got to a point where I was the technical lead of a next generation product for interventional cardiology. And we were doing clinical trials, and I was in control of the design, but I was losing control of the design because I wasn't in control of the CAD anymore. And I I think I'm good at CAD in part because I can see things spatially, and I think it's because I played all that tennis. Like, have you seen that State Farm commercial where the lady's like, that won't fit, and then, you know, she goes around telling people they're moving furniture and stuff. She's like, that's not going to fit. That's like me. Like, I can see something and know, like, within a percent or two if it's going to fit. I'm not formally trained as a mechanical engineer. I just work as a mechanical engineer because I did enough CAD and I designed enough stuff that worked that they let me do that job. But I'm barely educated. And I feel so out here, like I'm barely educated. The way to look back on how I came to practice is that I got burnt out. That I was tired of the hectic pace of the Silicon Valley, you know? But actually, it was working great for 15 years. And it's just that you get to a point where you see this glimpse of something you want to be, and you don't know how to get there. And so it's happened for me in my, like, where I was living, growing up, wanting to, like, get out, take that journey. It happened in my professional life, and it happened in my personal life with my family. This call to action, if you want to call it that. But those things have to be considered, because you have to distill down, why would you come and sit every day and work on this stuff? So that clarification is when the conditioning is like worked through. It's like, oh, okay, that's why I did that. But why I started is also really rewarding, right? Because you like, no, oh yeah, I can be good to myself, and I can really thank this person and aspire to be a person like that. They would see something in someone and say, ah, you know, here's this little book that in your time of difficulty, you'll look at it and it'll kind of seal the deal. Okay, I'm gonna go study engineering at Iowa, because this person thought I could do it. Otherwise, she wouldn't have given me this book.
Marty Travis, it's like our ongoing conversations from coffee during the morning, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, there's so much of a bureaucratic structure that is placed on us as human beings when growing up, from our parents, from our siblings, our friends, and even the regimes that we go and join, like, you know, Silicon Valley or the Air Force. It's and sometimes I think what happened is, and I wanted your input on this, that somewhere along the line, this bureaucracy of perfection and to perform makes it so hard on us that we bring that perfection and that bureaucracy home, and some way our own humanity and our own personal being, the real being, gets lost.
Yeah.
And that's what, when you were talking, I was feeling that.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know what your feelings were about that.
Mm. Thanks for the question. There's two parts that really stuck out for me. The drive to perfection within a large competitive organization. And anything large is going to have bureaucracy. And especially if it has a gaining idea, right? If it didn't have a gaining idea, if everyone was just cool to chill. That's like my sister-in-law said, where's the air conditioning? She got to the Airbnb the other night. She's like, where's the air conditioning? I thought, that's conditioning. She's from South Carolina. She's turning the thermostat. Like, it's not working. Yeah, you could push yourself really hard. And I was lucky to play tennis because I had some really tough losses and had to really face some things when I was younger, so that later when I was older and the situation had been different, I was at least having to like look at it, not run away from it. You know, I'm going to fail here. I'm going to miss this promotion. I'm going to not be the CEO that I thought I could have been, you know, 5 years ago. You're brilliant, but you got a lot to work on. You got a lot to work on. So there's a lightness to accepting that. And actually, it's funny. It's kind of like hilarious to think about that person you were trying to be. So that's that, you know, the perfection drive. There's like, we gotta at some point face our fallibility and our finiteness and how we fit in. And and we're not really warm and expansive people when we're trying to be something else than just ourselves. And if I could be that 10-year-old kid with this kind of understanding now, I'd be a dynamite tennis player. Yeah. I think the second part, if you can help me with what you said at the end, because it was a little bit of a different part.
Let the humanity go when we bring that kind of bureaucracy home. Because that's the feeling that I was getting from your training in tennis and your training, and somewhere along the lines you were losing your sense of the joy and gratitude, which brings us over and over again to our humanity.
Yeah. Our joy is it's emanating out with our gratitude. Like, it can't really exist, and we can't exist actually if we on some level we're not feeling that. And when we compare ourselves to others, which it feels like so much of society is actually set up to do, we only lose. We lose that vast sky that Suzuki's talking about. That's my home. It's there for me anytime I want it to be. That's it.
Thank you for your talk. There were two parts to the talk that really stood out to me. You seemed to really light up when you were talking about meaning in life. So, one is, it would be interesting to hear a little bit more about relationship practice. Especially kind of as you came to Zen.
Mm-hmm.
And then early on in your talk, you also talked about your relationship with the dog.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to hear if you care to share.
Yeah. Anything more about that. Yeah, thanks for the question. Relationships are on some level they're everything. Um, the way in which I met Rhea was, it was under a transition when I was open, and I was also hurt, and so to now be, you know, 20, almost 30 years long, 28 years from then, you know, our relationship has changed, and we're in more solid places as people, but she was having difficulty too. I mean, I look at my daughter, who's the same age now, and she's got a boyfriend, and I haven't met them. And they want to move in together, and you know, it's. I just saw a photo of him the other night, and I'm like, that was me. Like, I was that kid, and I had a hard time relating to anyone. And when you have a hard time relating to anyone, like, I don't think I'm alone. I was kind of a solitary kid who studied and like wanted to go achieve things. So didn't really form a lot of great relationships when I was young. I had some friends, but I didn't have meaningful relationships when I was younger. Like my younger daughter Alice does. She really does. And she's learning social skills that are like stuff I learned like 5 years ago, you know? And she knows things I don't know, so she helps me. But I was learning that's the rudimentary stuff with Rhea at first. And I think it helped me to understand how my parents were, because they were the same way. Like, they were a cult of two people that were very close, and they like took care of each other, but probably at the end of the day would come home and complain about the boss, or, you know, talk about what's, you know, going on with the news. And, you know, there could be, you know, just a critical way of seeing the world that I think a lot of loneliness builds up hard views. I learned this thing, and people need to know this because it will save the world one day. I read this book, and it says what's going to happen with the environment, and clearly, like, it's compelling enough that we need to change our policy on carbon capture. I did a lot of that. I was loud. I was argumentative. She was. And when we started to have children, we were like, whoa, okay, now we have to move in another direction. We have to be positive. We have to be mindful. Things need to be appropriate in the house. And that was a difficult thing to relearn, you know, how to expand your tribe to include more people, you know. And it's so worth it. And I'm so grateful that she just had acceptance for me. And I try to bring that into my life. So it's a simple thing, but it's dimensionless. It's a call to practice as well. And with my dog, with Moses, you know, he's almost 12, and he's a lot less hyper than he used to be. He's a lab like my dog when I was a kid, but he's named Moses. My dog as a kid was named Pavlov, which is kind of a nerdy name, but my parents named him. But it gives you an idea of, like, you know, it was cool to be scientifically thinking, socially scientifically thinking back then. And maybe I could have insisted on the name, for starters, like a different name. And then I got Moses and I got to name him. And so it's all good. We get what we need, you know. I'm more sensitive to like making him happy now. When he goes out into the backyard, he likes to like jump on his back and do the thing. He gets scratches and it's with the grass. At first I didn't tolerate that really. I'm like, get up, this is absurd. You're acting like a dog.
Like a dog.
And then I would like tolerate it more and more. And now when he does it, I get down on my knees and I massage him and I scratch his ears like he likes. And I can see it in his face, like, you know, how he enjoys it. Just like when my Aunt Shirley would tickle my back when I was a kid. She'd come down maybe once a year, but it was worth it for that one tickle session. Thanks.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.